level. And being someone who does traverse both worlds, we all have our strengths and we all have our weaknesses and we all have very different gifts. But to me, for all of us, if we come together and we unify, which is the underlying message of what we've been talking about, then those strengths and those weaknesses will be balanced out and we'll be able to do so much more because our voices will be that much louder.
We have 10 seconds, Tarana Burke, from dropping the ball at New Year's Eve in New York to the Golden Globes, your final comment. And then we're going to go into a part two discussion and post it online.
Yeah, I agree with Shailene. I think that this was an amazing moment for us, and I think it symbolizes what's to come.
We have to leave it there. I'll be speaking in Basalt, Colorado tonight at the Temporary. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Hi, I'm Shaheed Hamid, Cable board member. As we embark upon a new year, the World Arts Foundation and Cable wants to continue to honor the life and legacy of the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. On Monday, January the 15th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., the World Arts Foundation presents its 33rd consecutive tribute to this great American hero and advocate for peace, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Monday, January the 15th, at the Highland Christian Center, speakers, African drumming, and a variety of musical performances, also broadcast live here on KBOO Radio. A tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Where do we go from here? As people, as family, as community. Monday, January 15th, at 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Highland Christian Center, 7600 Northeast Gleason. Keep alive the dream.
Happy birthday!
Join KBOO Community Radio on Saturday, January 20th at the Oregon Historical Society as we celebrate our 50th anniversary with the exhibit 50 Years of KBOO. Along with the exhibit, we'll have speakers, entertainment, and an opportunity for you to record your own stories, experiences, and memories of KBOO Community Radio. That's 50 Years of KBOO, Saturday, January 20th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01. Coming up next is your Friday evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a woman's march for Palestine will begin at Pioneer Courthouse Square tomorrow.
Congress has extended a controversial surveillance program at the NSA.
And we'll check in with BARC, the organization dedicated to defending the forests of Mount Hood.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 12, 2018. I'm Ruben Lawrence.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. Tomorrow at noon in Portland, a group of women and allies are planning the Women's March for Palestine. They'll be meeting at Pioneer Courthouse Square to voice support for 16-year-old Ahed Tamimi and the hundreds of other children that are currently imprisoned in Israeli military prison camps. Ahed has been an outspoken member of the nonviolent resistance movement in her village of Nabib Saleh. In the West Bank since she was 10 years old. She is currently imprisoned with her mother. Several other members of her extended family have been harassed, attacked, and arrested. Today, according to the International Middle East Media Center, or IMEMC, based in Bethlehem in the West Bank, Ahed's 19-year-old cousin Mohammed Tamimi was arrested by Israeli security forces and taken to a notorious interrogation center. IMEMC posted a picture of Mohammed taken by his mother, smiling and flashing a peace sign as he was being arrested. Protests, including several women's marches, are planned across the world this month in solidarity with the Tamimi family. Tomorrow's march in Portland was organized by a broad coalition of faith-based and political groups, including Jewish Voice for Peace, a number of Protestant groups devoted to justice in the Holy Land, Portland Democratic Socialist, and student groups, among several others. That's tomorrow, Saturday, January 13 at noon at Pioneer Courthouse Square in downtown Portland. It's the Women's March for Palestine.
People around the world, including organizations like the African Union and United Nations, are outraged over President Donald Trump's most recent racist remarks. Trump bluntly criticized immigration to the U.S. from El Salvador, Haiti, and the African continent, referring to the countries with a scatological slur that we cannot repeat on the air. He made the remark repeatedly at a meeting with senators at the White House on Thursday to hash out a way forward for DACA. Trump then suggested the U.S. focus its immigrant entry policy on countries such as Norway. Many people from Norway, which is one of the wealthiest countries in the world by GDP per capita, dubbed the most happy nation on the planet, have said no thanks to the president's offer. According to Reuters, a politician representing Norway's Conservative Party in a municipality near Oslo said in a tweet, quote, "On behalf of Norway, thanks but no thanks," end quote. Rupert Colville, a spokesman for the UN Human Rights Office, said of Trump's remarks, quote, "There's no other word one can use but racist," end quote. The African Union said it was alarmed by President Trump's response in light of trade partnerships the U.S. has with sub-Saharan countries, but also because of his dismissal of America's historical relationship with Africa. A UN spokeswoman, Eba Kalondo, said, quote, "Given the historical reality of how many Africans arrived in the United States as slaves, this statement flies in the face of all accepted behavior and practice," end quote.
Trump initially told media outlets that his statement about Haitians was not racist, but later changed course. As of press time today, Trump was denying ever having made the comment. He said in a tweet that he did use tough language at the meeting, but, quote, "What was really tough was the outlandish proposal made. Big setback for DACA," end quote. Trump also denied demanding that Haitians be removed from negotiations about protected status for certain immigrants. According to CNN, White House spokesperson Raj Shah said in a statement that President Trump is making America stronger by, quote, "welcoming those who can contribute to our society, grow our economy, and assimilate into our great nation," end quote. A pattern of White House staff supporting Trump's most extreme remarks has been apparent since his campaign. Trump's path to the presidency involves staff members who have spoken on panels or written for publications for the alt-right and racist fringe groups, such as Trump's one-time campaign advisor Jacob Daniels, who addressed anti-immigration extremist group Oregon for Immigration Reform in August 2016. Also there at that event was racist blogger Paul Nachman of VDare and Chris Kobach, a nativist anti-immigration lawyer. Once in the White House, President Trump hired the executive chairman of alt-right white supremacist publication Breitbart to be his chief strategist, although that partnership has ended.
Yesterday, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to extend a controversial National Security Agency surveillance power that potentially affects millions of Americans' privacy rights. Democrats have been all over the airwaves recently accusing Donald Trump of abusing the Justice Department to go after his political enemies. But as Trevor Tim of the Freedom of the Press Foundation noted last night, the Democrats in Congress just decided to give Donald Trump more power, which he could potentially use against Americans who attract negative attention from his administration. The bill is an extension of what's known as Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, which allows the NSA to, without a warrant, target people in other countries who are communicating with Americans. This means that they can collect the personal communications of Americans without their knowledge. Currently, the NSA has over 100,000 foreign nationals under this type of surveillance. But it also has the communications data of the potentially millions of Americans whose who those foreign nationals talked to, texted with, and emailed over the course of the surveillance. As reported by the New York Times, the FBI and other intelligence agencies have access to this vast database of information and regularly search it without a warrant for crimes that have nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism.
Being the mayor of any major American city is a tough job, and being the mayor of Portland may be among the toughest. Our form of city government means that the mayor doesn't have the authority that other big city mayors have, but he or she will still catch most of the flack. Since becoming mayor, Ted Wheeler has been the target of frequent criticism from progressives, and KBOO's Ray Bodwell has been one of those critics. But this time, he thinks the mayor is on the right track.
I cannot imagine why anyone would actually want to be the mayor of Portland. Talk about a thankless job. Here's an optimistic Ted Wheeler addressing reporters the day after last November's election.
Obviously, I'm really excited about the results last night, and I'm very proud of the campaign that we ran. It was a positive campaign. It was an issues-oriented campaign. It was about real people and the real problems that people are facing in this community.
Here's the mayor addressing a crowd of angry protesters outside City Hall 25 days into his new job.
Yeah. This is an important issue, and it's important.
Just a minute.
Just a minute.
Just a minute.
Just a minute.
And here's Wheeler addressing protesters who presented a list of demands at the front door of his home in the middle of the night after less than 2 months on the job.
Okay, you're never going to believe me.
No, I can't make you your actions do not prove that you are listening to us.
I'm standing here on the doorstep of my home.
I'll bet he had second thoughts about his career choice that night. I admit that I've come down hard on Mayor Wheeler in commentaries on more than one occasion during his first year. But to be fair, in our archaic commission form of city government, Wheeler may have the title of mayor, but he does not have the executive authority that comes with being the mayor in every other major city in the U.S. In Portland, each commissioner is the chief executive of the bureau or bureaus that they are assigned to lead. As mayor, Wheeler presides over city council meetings and assigns which bureaus the commissioners are responsible for. If you think it takes too long to get an answer when you call 911, that's the Bureau of Emergency Services. Amanda Fritz is responsible. If you think the bus service in your neighborhood sucks, that's the Bureau of Transportation. Take it up with Dan Saltzman. Two of the bureaus that Wheeler assigned himself were police and housing. As police commissioner, he did fire Mike Marshman. He brought in Danielle Outlaw, a female African-American police professional who previously served as deputy chief in Oakland, California. The jury is still out on that decision, but she's only been on the job a little over 3 months, and changing the culture in a department with a long history of institutionalized racism can't be easy. We need to give her some time. Last summer, in his role as housing commissioner, Wheeler relaunched Fast Starts, a program aimed at accelerating funding for low-income housing projects. In November, he announced plans to build an 11-story high-rise of affordable apartments. The project, called Framework, almost immediately generated controversy because it will be the nation's tallest wood frame structure and will cost $29 million to build. Critics complain that the square foot cost will be 60% higher per apartment than is called for in the city guidelines. Wheeler agreed that the overall cost is too high, but quickly pointed out that the city is only on the hook for $6 million towards a total cost of $29 million, with the rest coming from a mix of government and private sources. Even if the state's contribution of $2 million falls through and the city has to make up the difference, Portland's contribution is still less than 30% of the total cost. And we'd actually be building something, not just talking about it. It's easy to criticize from the sidelines, and I've criticized Mayor Wheeler in the past. But in this case, I think he's doing the right thing in trying to push through the Framework project. We spent a lot of time talking about the housing crisis in Portland, but we never seem to get beyond talk. Wheeler is actually trying to move past the talking stage and do something. He's trying to play the role of a big city mayor. Good for him. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Thank you.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, a production of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. At 6, it's Bread and Roses, featuring a discussion with writer Polly Campbell about stress. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will see a low of 42 with a 10% chance of rain, and tomorrow will reach a near-tropical 58 degrees. Today in history, in 1945, the Red Army under Marshal Georgi Zhukov began the Vistula Oder Offensive, which brought them within striking distance of Berlin. The offensive saw the capture of major western Polish cities from the Nazis, but not until after a long pause in operations allowed the Germans to put down the Warsaw Uprising by destroying the city and killing or enslaving its inhabitants. The Soviet delay before Warsaw is recognized as one of the most cynical actions of the worst war in human history. The quote of the day is from Polish poet and writer Czesław Miłosz. Love means to look at yourself the way one looks at distant things, for you are only one thing among many.
It is 5:15, and that's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
As the royal triumvirate of Donald Trump, Paul Ryan, and Mitch McConnell continue their perverse quest to turn our America into a gold-plated Trumplandistan for oligarchs, they keep insisting that their blatantly elitist schemes will magically elevate the middle class and even the poor, delivering a 7-course dinner to everyone. Yeah, right. As we've now seen from their totally regressive new tax law, your and my 7-course dinner turns out to be a 6-pack and a possum. In fact, as the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center reports, 10 years from now, 83% of the benefits in the Trump-Ryan-McConnell Tax Act will be flowing to the wealthiest families, while more than half of America's middle-income and poor people will actually see their taxes rise during the next decade. Meanwhile, this egregious giveaway to undeserving corporate elites will add as much as $1.5 trillion to the federal deficit. No problem, says the slap-happy triumvirate, for we have a plan to cover the cost of these lavish tax cuts we've given to the royals, including cuts for the gilded Trump family, which just happens to be one of the Act's top beneficiaries. Has Trump himself explained the plan? We're going to go into welfare reform. Yes, the plan is to cut such essential safety net programs as children's health care, food stamps, jobless programs, and, as Ryan now publicly admits, they intend to cut your and my Medicare and Social Security. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we have here is plutocracy in action. The precious few are intentionally knocking down and locking down the many to further enrich themselves. This is why the social cancer of inequality is spreading so rampantly in America, devouring the very middle class that Trump and company are using, ironically and cynically, as an Orwellian rationale for passing their plutocratic agenda.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
In 1993, two friends, attorney Greg Dyson and musician John Rancher, issued a call to action after witnessing large clear cuts and old growth logging in Mount Hood National Forest. They hiked to each timber sale and made note of the markings in the forest, pointing out the discrepancies between the scale of logging and what was officially allowed. Soon, Greg and John found others who shared their passion for protecting Mount Hood's forest and began sharing what they found. Eventually, their organization, BARC, grew into a diverse group of dedicated professionals and passionate activists. Officially founded in 1999, BARC has since trained hundreds of volunteers on the basics of forest policy, brought thousands of people to the Mount Hood National Forest, and saved tens of thousands of acres of forest from logging and road building. We have in the studio today Leah Benlin and Kim Hack from BARC. Welcome, Kim and Leah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. So the first question I have is, what does BARC do exactly?
Sure, this is Leah. So BARC is an organization that helps to protect Mount Hood National Forest, and specifically from logging operations in order to protect that area for, you know, recreational use and beauty and the environment in general.
Okay. I think everyone in Portland can agree that that's important work. But why do volunteers lead hikes each month?
We find the BARC About Hike, which is a monthly free hike that BARC puts on, to be an accessible way to get into BARC. And it helps get us out to the place we love, and then we can take some more in-depth time to examine different topics, and we'll get into what our topic this month is, and then get to those timber sales and around those timber sales to better understand them. So great educational opportunity and the perfect way to get started with BARC if you've always been curious.
It's also a really good way to get people out into the forest who might have a hard time getting there otherwise, because there are carpools every month for people who don't have their own car and need to get out.
Yeah, I think that's important, because I have a couple of friends who it's harder for them to get out there for hikes. So yeah, having that kind of transportation would be really helpful. So what is this month's BARC hike about?
So this month, we are specifically talking about beavers and beavers' impact on the environment. I have recently been learning that beavers do so many cool things, like they help to sequester carbon, they help to mitigate forest fires. What else, Kim?
Yeah, and one of their big functions is they create these dams. Everyone knows the beaver is indeed busy, and it creates all of these kind of retention ponds, which is great for all the aquatic life that lives there. And it's pretty essential. And so across our landscape, there used to be so many more beaver, and that is just not the case anymore. And so we're excited to get out there and talk about the importance of beaver and also the potential for reintroduction to beaver in these places where they've been extirpated, meaning they used to occur there and they no longer occur there.
So when is the when is this month's hike? What are some of the details so people can join you?
Sure. So this month, the hike, actually every month, the hike is on the second Sunday. And we are meeting this month at the grocery outlet in Hollywood. And we're meeting there at 9 a.m. It's good to arrive just a little bit before 9 a.m. To meet up with the carpools and check in. If you're able to drive, that's great. And you can bring your car along. Make sure that you have good weather for, or good clothes for hiking in cold weather.
We'll bring the good weather too.
Yeah. no dogs. It's kid friendly. Anything else?
Yeah, and just bring some gas money if you are a passenger.
Win a lunch.
Okay. And so just one thing I'm curious about is if either of you have kind of your favorite hike that you've gone on so far through BARC.
Oh, probably everyone that I've done. It's amazing to get a bunch of different people together who like to volunteer to do this, because they all have their own specialties. And every time I go out with BARC, I learn something new, something amazing that I hadn't even thought that I would want to know about.
Yeah, it's always those unexpected surprises that makes the hike. And we're going to go to a pretty special place, to Alder Creek.
Okay. All right, well, that sounds great. I'll see if I can join you myself, if possible.
Okay, great.
Please do.
So BARC's website is www.bark-out.org, and you can also find all of their events, as well as articles about forest policy and ecology, on their Facebook page, facebook.com/BARC4MountHood. That's BARC for MT Hood. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Ethiopia has just banned the adoption of children by foreigners based on concerns that they face abuse and child neglect abroad. Ethiopia is also one of the largest sources for international adoptions by U.S. citizens, accounting for close to 20% of the total adopted from other nations. In 2013, a U.S. couple, Larry and Carrie Williams of Washington State, were convicted of killing an adopted Ethiopian girl by starving and beating her. The horrendous case started a debate about foreign adoption policy and culture. According to the BBC's Emmanuel Igunza, in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, I apologize. Addis Ababa. The process of adoption in Ethiopia has faced serious questions, with rights groups claiming that it was prone to abuse by human traffickers who saw it as an easy and lucrative market. Lawmakers, including those in Denmark, whose country recently stopped the adoption of Ethiopian children, now say orphans and other children in vulnerable situations should be cared for locally with support structures in order to keep them safe. Some leaders believe Ethiopia lacks the social services to care for the children. More than 15,000 Ethiopian children have been adopted in the United States since 1999, and many are also taken into European countries such as Spain, France, and Italy.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture from Native Voice One. Find more stories and podcasts at nv1.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Food sovereignty projects across the country are helping tribes provide traditional foods to their communities as Native Americans continue to face high rates of obesity, diabetes, and other diseases. Health professionals point to a lack of access to fresh, healthy foods as a contributing factor. In our USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism series, we take a look at an effort in New Mexico to help community members grow traditional crops. Farmers Bailey Morgan and Emilio Bailon clean seeds using their bodies and fans to get debris off the seeds. The two men oversee a seed bank and pueblo farm at Tesuque Pueblo in New Mexico. Morgan, a member of the tribe, says the seed bank began nearly a decade ago with a small storage space on the pueblo and eventually evolved into a two-story building, which today houses seeds from tribes across the country.
Just like how you have water protectors, you have seed protectors, and that's what we are. Maintaining your traditional seeds, planting them every year, and just, you know, making sure that they're taken care of. Just like we built this for the seeds. This is their home.
Good, wait, you know.
Bailon is Inca from Bolivia. He says preserving seeds has long been important to indigenous people worldwide.
I would say to you, our ancestors, for thousands of years, look, the Hopi, Quechua people, any indigenous people, they have his seeds for thousands of years.
The men not only strive to protect traditional seeds, they also share knowledge about organic farming methods with school children, tribal members, and international visitors. A short walk from the seed bank are plots of land for members to farm, a fruit orchard, and greenhouses with herbs, fruits, and vegetables. Traditional crops like corn, beans, and squash have long been staples to Pueblo people. But Morgan says the arrival of settlers and modern busy lives have changed the way his fellow tribal members eat today.
People are easily, you know, going to go to the store and buy the products that are available to them at the stores instead of farming the fields. People work eight hours a day, and then, you know, they don't want to go home and prepare meals. They can easily just go and get fast food, and, you know, that's made an impact here.
Like other Native nations across the country, Morgan says diseases linked to food choices, such as diabetes, are common in his community. He'd like to see that addressed through incorporating more traditional foods into daily life. And he says traditional farming is part of the health and wellness of communities.
Being a Pueblo man, that's, you know, first and foremost of what I believe is going back to the land and taking care of it. You know, our ancestors left it for us, and so it's our duty to go ahead and keep it going, you know, for future generations.
A six-year program with 17 tribes through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found potential new opportunities for using traditional foods to address chronic illness and improve health outcomes. A bill to federally recognize six Virginia tribes passed the Senate Thursday and was sent to the president's desk. The tribes have been seeking the status for decades. Among benefits, if signed into law, it would grant the tribes legal standing with the U.S. government and allow tribes to access federal programs. The tribes do have official recognition with Virginia. The Tulsa World reports the Cherokee Nation plans to pursue its opioid case in state court after a federal judge ruled this week the tribe cannot go after major corporations in tribal court due to jurisdiction. The Oklahoma tribe is accusing drug companies and distributors of not preventing the flow of illegally prescribed drugs to Cherokee citizens. The tribe says it's fighting widespread abuse of opioids. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell and Jasmine Moneymaker. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. Coming up Monday morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on More Talk Radio, a conversation with the late Yolanda King on her famous father's path to nonviolence. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to the Columbia Riverkeepers Conservation Director about how the thin green line is holding firm against an onslaught of fossil fuel development. And at 11, our special Martin Luther King Day of special programming begins. Where do we go from here? A live broadcast from Highland UCC of the 33rd Annual MLK Tribute. KABU keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to the KABU.fm website and click on Donate to become a member today. Thanks for listening and have a good evening. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Ruben. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, everybody.